And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. Today we begin with University of Massachusetts Amherst Economics Professor Emeritus Richard Wolff. His education includes degrees from Harvard, Stanford, and Yale, and is the author of many books, the latest entitled Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. And he joins us from New York City via Skype. Welcome to you, Professor Richard Wolff. Thanks for joining us. Professor Wolff. We seem to be having a little bit of a technical difficulty there. Professor Wolff, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. What does a self-directed enterprise mean, as you've, of course, written this book all about that concept?
Well, it's a response to the crisis in the global capitalist economy, and most notably here in the United States. It's a response in the sense that it offers a solution, not more regulations of the sort that haven't proven able to prevent such a crisis, or for that matter, to fix it, of the sort that we're in now. I should remind everyone that it started in December of 2007, which makes it now coming to the end of its fifth year. It's a solution in the sense that the structural changes made in the American economy after the last time capitalism collapsed in the Great Depression have likewise not succeeded in preventing another catastrophe of the sort we're in now. So it's an attempt to say, that we need to learn that the things we did last time, the rules, the regulations, simply were not adequate. We left our basic organization of enterprises, those institutions that produce the goods and services we all depend on, basically untouched after the last collapse. It's still the major shareholders who select the board of directors who make all the decisions in our enterprises, what to produce, how to produce it, where to produce it, whether to close shop here in the United States and reopen in China or elsewhere. And finally, they make the decision what to do with the profits that all of our work together produces. It is a blatantly ineffective system. It enriches a tiny 1%, as we know, and a few others who are their servants, and it leaves the mass of the people not only unable to democratically shape their work lives, but in constant fear of unemployment, of job insecurity, of lost benefits. I could go on, but life we're all leading now, and so I don't need to. And so the solution I've come up with that draws on the rich tradition of cooperative enterprise here in the United States and elsewhere is that we finally have to, in a sense, complete the democratic revolution. We brought democracy to a point in our
Professor, it seems you sort of poo-poo the input of investors, but if they are investing much of the money to begin these firms, shouldn't they have a big say in how it's spent and allocated?
I don't think so. I think that we have to take the step back and ask how it happened in the first place that a tiny number of people were able to gather into their hands the disposable resources of our society to be in the position of making a highly undemocratic decision, namely where to invest their money. It isn't they who produced that wealth by themselves. They were the people who gathered into their hands the wealth produced by everybody. And the decision of how to invest the wealth produced by everybody should never have been allowed to gather into the hands of a tiny number who then make their decisions, or not, in the way we all have to live with it. Just one statistic. All reporters now show, from the IRS to the business interests, that roughly $2 trillion worth of wealth is being held as cash by the major corporations in the United States who have deemed it useful in their private profit calculations not to invest that money even though it could employ and produce the rest of us needs. So rather than pander to the few who've gathered into their hands the investable stuff, we ought to be challenging the undemocratic nature of allowing such important decisions to be made by such a tiny minority.
Professor, let's talk about the WSDEs that are such a major part of this democracy at work movement, the workers' self-directed enterprises. What are they? Can you tell us more about them?
Certainly, I'd be glad to. Here is the idea that, let's just take an imaginary enterprise that has 5,000 workers in it, but it would apply equally whether it was 50 or 50,000. But in this enterprise, the 4,900 of the folks come to work Monday through Friday, 8 o'clock, stay till 5, pour out their brains and their muscles to produce whatever the company is in the business of producing, and at the end of each day, they go home. They leave behind the fruits of their labor, and they leave all the relevant decisions to a tiny group of people. The board of directors of most corporations, and that's where most of the business of the United States is done, in corporations. The boards of directors are usually 15 to 20 people. They are selected by the major shareholders, likewise a group of usually 10 to 20 people. They make all the decisions that the 5,000 workers, or excuse me, the 4,900 who do the work, are required to live with. They can close the factory. They can choose technological mechanisms that are not good for people's health, physical or mental. They can change what it is the company produces, and they can use the profits generated to enhance their own managers' salaries, to pay dividends to those investors, to pay the cost of moving production somewhere else, leaving the workers and their communities in a total economic disaster. This is not an acceptable situation, and the alternative would be pretty straightforward and simple. The workers themselves would become their own board of directors. That's what workers' self-directed enterprises means. Monday to Thursday, they would continue to come to work and do whatever the particular tasks were in the division of labor that each of them was assigned to do. But Friday, the life would be different. They would come to work the same hours, but they would spend all day in meetings. And there they would decide democratically, one worker, one vote, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. It is in that sense a democratic workplace where the conditions, including the salaries and so on, would be determined in a majority vote by the workers themselves. This has existed throughout American history. It exists all over the United States today. Workers have tried to go in that direction. They have been successful in some cases, not successful in others. Their rates of success are no worse than those of capitalist enterprises with their hierarchical top-down organizations.
Professor, how about on a local level, say the small entrepreneur? For example, say I start my own local delivery service here in South Florida. Shouldn't I, as the entrepreneur, the one who puts the money up and the brains behind the operation, be able to control it as I see fit?
I don't think so. I think that you're right to say that the person who has some initiative, who can come up with an interesting new idea, ought to be recognized in that way, perhaps ought to be even given a chance to profit in a personal way from such a breakthrough. But that's a completely different question of how you institutionalize the regular production of whatever it is anyone has created. And there the question is, just like you might say a country or a new society was founded by people who made the difficult journey from another part of the world, took all the risks involved in setting up a new community, we've never allowed that to be an argument that would trump the democratic organization of that community. And I would argue the same applies here. Whatever rewards we want to give to entrepreneurs, to innovators, and I'm fine with that, that's a different matter from how you institutionalize for the years, the decades, and the centuries thereafter – in the normal organization of production that engages the vast majority of us, you do not need and you ought not to hobble the democracy, to deny the democracy of the mass of people in a perpetual subordination to those and their descendants who came up with the original idea. I don't think there's a contradiction here. You can reward and recognize the breakthrough at the same time that you acknowledge the superiority of a democratic organization of work over the kind of hierarchical, undemocratic organization that most Americans are now subject to.
Professor, the New York Times Magazine says you're probably America's most prominent Marxist economist. Is that accurate, and how does that sit with you?
Well, I have no idea whether it's accurate or not, since there is no institution that I'm aware of that awards titles of this sort. That title was invented by Adam Davidson, the writer of that article in the New York Times, based on an interview of me and whatever research he did about me. Let me explain my political or intellectual orientation if it's of interest. Have I found Marxist theory useful? Absolutely. Has it helped and shaped part of my thinking? I say so with pleasure and acknowledgement. Marx and Marxism is a critical approach to capitalism. Like every system before it, feudalism, slavery, or any other you might identify, capitalism has produced those who love it and those who are critical of it. And any reasonable, balanced education in the history or the reality of capitalism would need to listen to and take cognizance of those who celebrate it and those who are critical of it. Unfortunately, in American higher education, for most of the last 50 years, although it was not that way before, but over for the last 50 years, as a horrible legacy of the Cold War, it was thought necessary that economics be only devoted to the celebration of capitalism and not to the critical insights about its flaws, its weaknesses, and its fundamental instability. We are now paying the price in the United States of ignoring the Marxist critique of economics because, having not studied what's wrong with this system when it breaks down the way it has in the last 5 years, our leaders and their advisors are stunningly incapable of figuring out solutions. They would have been much better off had they studied the critical side. You know, I use a metaphor. If you want to understand the family down the street that has a mother, a father, and two children, and you know that one of the children thinks it's the greatest family ever and the other one is quite critical, that if you want a balanced understanding of the family, let alone to help it in a time of difficulty, you need to talk to the two children, not just one of them. And that's the problem with Marxian economics, that it has been neglected. I have found it useful. The ideas I've come up with, the audiences I've approached have found it useful. And I think we're now mature enough as a nation that finally we can make up for the terrible reality that the last 50 years have been a kind of taboo on analyzing critically our economic system. A strange thing in a country that questions marriage, that questions our educational system, our health delivery system. But when it came to the capitalist economic system, despite its obvious inadequacies, the inequality it creates, the cycles we are subjected to, it has had a free pass. And like always happens when you give an institution a free pass and an avoidance of criticism and only cheerleading is allowed, you get that system to indulge its worst tendencies, and that's what we're living through now.
But, Professor, what about the historic failures of state socialism? Of course, the Soviets, the Eastern European bloc, North Korea, Cuba, there really haven't been very many success stories.
Well, it depends a little bit on what you mean by success. Have they had major problems?
A thriving economy?
Well, it depends, again, how you measure. The literacy rate in Cuba is higher than it is in the United States. If one of the things an economic system is supposed to do is build up and develop the society it lives in, then the Cubans and many of those others you mentioned have the kinds of education systems, medical care systems, and so on, from which the United States, if it weren't taboo, would learn something and could adopt useful things that have been developed in those societies. The notion that we are a great success and everybody else is a failure is a conceit that I don't think withstands any kind of systematic examination. There are terrible flaws with their system, as there have been with ours. But capitalism does not have one face. Capitalism is the system in Pinochet's Chile. Capitalism with private enterprises running their enterprises were true in Italian and German fascism. We don't want to point to those because we prefer capitalisms of a different sort. Good. But then we have to recognize that socialisms and communisms come in all different sorts, and that one can be very critical of some of them without throwing out the baby with the bathwater and thinking in an honest way, well, what are the features of these societies? They are much greater equality of income. They are much greater equality of opportunity for people in public education and 100 other venues than we've been able to achieve, or at least than many capitalisms have been able to achieve. I think that kind of a balanced approach would be far better for us than a blanket dismissal of societies about which most Americans learn very little in the school, other than the sort of dismissive approach to them, which is not sustainable once you actually study what they've achieved, what their strengths and their weaknesses are.
Professor, isn't bold and individual initiative dampened in your model for, I mean, hasn't it shown to be dampened through other societies that have used your ideas?
Not at all. Let me give you one example from the recent past and up until the present of a cooperative workers-run enterprise that has probably no peer in terms of its extraordinary success. I'm referring to something called the Mondragon Corporation, north of Spain, very famous example. In 1956, suffering from the effects of World War II and the Civil War in Spain, the northern region of Spain, often referred to as the Basque area, just below the Pyrenees Mountains, was suffering unbelievable unemployment, and there was no prospect of any capitalists thinking they could make profit by hiring people. Capitalism was clearly not working for the mass of the people. A Catholic priest, Father Arizmendi, therefore decided to try something else, a cooperative enterprise where workers would not only set up the enterprise but run it collectively and democratically. And so he did that. In 1956, he began. That effort has been extraordinarily successful. It has had to compete against eventual capitalist competitors, both within that region and from elsewhere in Spain, and the co-ops had to figure out how they could outcompete the capitalist enterprises. And they've done that with stunning success. From an original group of six workers working with Father Arizmendi, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain today employs 125,000 people. It is the largest corporation in the Basque area, the seventh largest corporation in Spain. It is a corporation composed of several hundred co-ops in which the workers make all the decisions. They hire and fire the managers, and they are the ones who decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. They are a stunning success story. They show that co-ops can work with small and also large enterprises. And there are parallel examples in other parts of the world, but I pick one that is stunningly successful simply to put to rest the very convenient self-congratulatory approach of those who favor capitalism, who want the rest of us to believe that it's the only system that works, that it's the only system that's viable, that it's the only system that has success. You should be aware that every year here in the United States, as in other capitalist countries, a huge number of capitalist enterprises collapse, go bankrupt, fail. And that is the normal way of capitalism. So that what you need to compare, if you want to, is what the history of small and medium and large co-ops has been relative to the very unstable history of capitalist enterprises. Otherwise, the comparison is flawed and does not fairly represent what the experience has been. And as I say, there are many co-ops that have flourished in the United States throughout its history and at the present.
Well, what is the difference between a workers' self-directed enterprise and a co-op?
Good question. The word co-op, because it has a long history, has covered many different things. So, for example, co-op can mean, and does mean in many parts of the United States, a collective buying activity. As when friends and neighbors in a neighborhood get together and set up, for example, what is called a food co-op. What effectively that means, in most cases, is that the friends and neighbors buy food in bulk, have it brought to a central place, and then distribute it amongst themselves in order to realize the economies that come from buying in bulk. Similarly, you have another kind of co-op, which is a sales co-op. That's where 25 separate vineyard owners who grow grapes decide they can do better marketing their grapes or the wine that they get from the grapes as a cooperative together rather than each of them trying to navigate the market individually. So one would be a buyer's co-op, as in the food example. One would be a seller's co-op. There are thousands, tens of thousands of those across the United States, and they're interesting because they show the viability, the attractiveness, the successfulness of cooperative activity rather than individual activity in our economy. But I'm more interested in the very different matter of a workers co-op, or sometimes called a productive or producers co-op. That's where the work is done collectively. Not the buying, not the selling, but the work itself, the production act, the use of brains and muscles by people together, not only combining their individual capabilities to do the work, but for the first time, being able to combine their individual interests and capabilities to not only do what other people tell them when they tell them, but also to participate in the design, the organization, the strategic planning of an enterprise. They depend on those things for their jobs, their incomes, and their lives. They ought to be able to participate. They ought to have the educations that would develop those skills and talents, which responds to your earlier question. We lose the enormous innovation and creativity of the vast majority of our workers because we keep them in a subordinate position in the workplace. We do not give them anything like the education, the training, and above all, the opportunities to show what they could do in the way of design, directing, innovating, and we lose as a society way more than we gain by holding on to the top-down hierarchical capitalist system, which perpetuates this kind of subordination.
Professor, we only have a minute or so left, but take us through the worker self-directed enterprise operation as far as environmental issues. Would that form of business tend to probably have a little better environmental conscious or to be meeting guidelines?
Absolutely. And one of the strong supports emerging for worker self-directed enterprise does come from the ecological environmental movement. And the idea here is really very simple. In most capitalist corporations, particularly the larger ones, the board of directors sits in some major city, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, New York. They make decisions covering many plants and offices and stores scattered around, or indeed around the world. When confronted with a fine technology that will improve profits, but maybe not so good for the health or welfare or mental stability of their workers, they are tempted and often fall for the temptation to pick the profitable technology and to pay the cost or hope to evade the cost of all of its ecological damage. Obviously, if workers themselves breathe the air, drink the water, hear the noise, suffer the psychological and other stresses, if they're the ones making decisions about technology, if they know that any technology they adopt will be not only for them an issue, but for their family, their children, their neighbors, their community, we're not going to have anything like the cavalier attitude toward environmental degradation that is made when the decisions are driven by profits as calculated by the tiny group of shareholders and boards of directors at the top. It's like the same question with our inequality of income. The biggest, best, and fastest way to change the inequality of income is to stop allowing those tiny groups of shareholders and boards of directors to allocate the profits to those sky-high multi-million-dollar packages that create the absurd wealth and obscene wealth that we have in the midst of an economic crisis that is affecting most people.
Professor,
if they did it, they would never distribute the income that way.
Professor, we have to be wrapping it up. We've been speaking with Professor Emeritus Richard Wolff of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We've been discussing his latest book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez next with South Florida poet and author Michael Haneck.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys.
You can begin your fiction story, explore the basics of blogging, or create your nonfiction tale with the Center for Literature and Theater at Miami-Dade College. 8-week-long workshops for writers begin September 18th and include one designed for talented teens. All courses are taught by experienced instructors who have published extensively and hold advanced degrees. Classes are small and allow for extensive individualized attention. Registration and details at the center at mdc.org and at 305-237-3023.
Did you know that Medicare's annual election period now starts on October 15th? Soon it will be time to make important decisions about your coverage. The state's SHINE program can guide you through the enrollment period. Why not call SHINE today at 1-800-963-5337?
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Michael Haneck's poetry is an antidote for our technology-driven alienation from nature. In reminding us of the world beyond the city and the suburbs, he tries to heal the divide between our material and spiritual selves. His new book, The Animals Beyond Us, argues that we have more in common with our four-legged friends than we would like to admit. The author of 12 collections of poetry, Haneck is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Haneck. He began by asking him if and why poetry matters.
Poetry matters in our time, particularly because it's a way for us to explore the, for lack of a better word, the soul of our time through an examination of and exploration of the individual consciousness of the poet. One of the things I've noticed about poetry over the years is that as I work on it, I go into the rhythms and the ways of thinking that are specific and particular to myself. But I also, at times, if I'm lucky, seem to find a place where I'm able to speak for the unspoken that is moving through the world now in some way that we can't capture unless we practice poetry. I think one of the reasons this is the fact is that poetry is very formal. And it's a formal way of using language. And the form functions to allow part of the mind to, in a sense, become distracted from its ordinary surface concerns and thus follow something that isn't quite as obvious to us all, to that mind in its daily, everyday life. Thus, I think we get into a place that is, as I said, very specific to the individual, very non-consumer, very improvisational, and very humane. So to me, poetry that I write and poetry that I read, it feeds those aspects of life that are, I think, being challenged from all sides today.
Well, you mentioned form or formal.
Yes.
A lot of people write poetry, but they don't really know anything about form.
Mm-hmm.
For them, poetry is just a vehicle for them to let out their emotions.
Yes.
What would you suggest to them?
Okay. I would suggest to somebody who wants to write poetry, but also to somebody who wants to read poetry, that they think about form as something different than structure. Form is has something to do with structure, and there are structures that can become forms. But form is... Well, form can take many forms. That is, it can be traditional in its manifestation, as in a sonnet or a villanelle or a sestina, that kind of form. But it can also be something that comes out of the poet's careful listening to the line as he or she writes the poem. I think that one of the weaknesses of contemporary poetry might be, I don't want to be too emphatic about this, but might be the fact that fewer poets have practiced form. practiced in form. And by saying this, I don't mean necessarily that everybody should go write, you know, sonnets for a year or practice in a slavish way in response to form, but that one understands the function of form in writing a poem. And that function has to do with, as I spoke about, as I said a little bit earlier, has to do with the ways that we can distract and thus dig into our minds. Without some use of form, it's very difficult to do that, and we're just writing sort of something like free writing. So I think that the best approach for a young poet to take is to write formal poems, write free verse poems, write, you know, listen really carefully, train his or her ear so that there's a sense of form that's built through that practice. It's poetry to me is a practice.
We're speaking with poet Michael Hedick, whose new collection is entitled The Animals Beyond Us. About that book, The Animals Beyond Us, it's aptly titled. It's filled with beasts, birds, insects. Why all the non-humans? Mm.
Yes. Why all the non-humans?
Yes.
It's a good question. I'm not really sure. It's not something that I set out to do. The way I wrote this book is I said to myself, I wrote it during the summer, when I'm off from teaching, I said to myself, I'm going to write 100 poems, and I'm going to use this structure. We're talking about form. The form I'm going to use is I'm going to do a 4-beat line. I'm not going to have any stanza breaks. I'm going to try to think by association, and I'm going to write these 100 poems before I go back and look at any of the poems I've written, so that I'm moving forward all the time. So that was the form that this book took. When I went back over it, I saw what it was, and I revised the poems that seemed interesting to revise. And I actually realized that what the book was about was about myself as a person 10 years after my father had died. It's not a book that's grieving for the loss of my father, but it's a book that for the first time can realize that fact of life in the sense that we all have to realize at some point. So.
Well, I noticed you really like bees.
Yes.
What is it about the bee that attracts you?
Well, it's probably the fact that bees make that wonderful buzzing sound. It's probably the fact that bees pollinate flowers. It's probably just this interesting fact that you go outside in your garden every once in a while and all these bees are swarming all around and you feel like, wow, the world is much more vividly alive than I had, you know, been feeling in my life. And so bees to me, snakes I think are this too, for me too, are sort of reminders of the vividness of the world outside our own concerns and our own little human selves.
Well, one of your poems is called Like Hunger.
Yes.
In it, your narrator is at a crossroads. He says, I should leave what I have been and enter what I am now. It reminded me of Donald Justice's poem, Men at 40. Mm. Which is also about a man accepting the fact that he is entering the last phase of his life. What was the inspiration behind Like Hunger?
Well, the answer to that is, well, thanks for the Donald Justice connection. Wonderful poet who lived for a long time in Miami. Anybody who wants to learn about form might do well to read. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
No, what was the inspiration?
Oh, the inspiration was just that I was trying to write a lot of poems as fast as I could using this particular sense of controlling structure. See, to me, one of the things that's happened as I've grown older is I don't so much come to a poem, a poem with an idea of something I'm going to say. I come to the process of writing the poem to discover what I have to say. I write every day, so I pretty much get up early in the morning and work for an hour or two. On a day when I don't have work until later, I work for more than 2 hours, and I just write the poems, and then I go back over them and I formally put them together more than I would say I would try to make sense of them. I don't think making sense is really the goal in the poems as I see them. What it is to make something that's vivid and feels alive and feels like it sings. You know, that's really what I'm after.
Well, we're speaking with poet Michael Hedick, whose new collection is The Animals Beyond Us. Do you get upset when people confuse the narrator of your poems, with yourself?
Well, I don't get upset, but I realize that those people don't understand poetry, because except for certain very small number of confessional poets, almost anybody who writes poetry who uses an I is using that I as a way of investigating the I that is larger than the I. So it doesn't upset me, but it just is just one of those facts that we have to deal with. And
right,
you know, people are always coming to me and they're saying, did you really have that happen to you? Was that really, you know, did you really do that? And I say, no, you know, that wasn't me. That was me imagining something that could have happened. And, you know, but then Colleen, my wife, is always saying, yeah, you'd say that's not really what happened. But, you know, like she sees the truth that it, like, is biographical in the I, you know, she challenges my sense that it's not me.
Well, that device would be called a persona.
Yeah, I guess so.
A mask.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And I guess the perfect example of that is Robert Frost, because readers always confuse his gentle, wise yes. narrators with the man
with his fierce
guy. Actually an awful human being.
Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm not a good enough poet to be an awful human being. So
well, okay. It's nice. Here's another poem that I liked.
Okay, thank you.
The Musician. At first, it appears to be about two men, but isn't it really about one man who's torn between two
yes.
possible lives?
Yes, I think it is. It is both, I think, in a certain sense. I'm not sure it boils down to either of those choices. So I guess that's what I like about that poem as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't resolve itself.
Right, right, exactly. It's like it kind of has an open-ended.
Right, exactly.
Right.
You know, and that's the kind of poem that I think one writes at this age in life, which is middle age. You know, you're kind of, who am I? What am I doing? Where am I? I'm spending my days working on writing. You know, which is kind of like playing music, which is kind of like being in the basement away from the world and imagining this other life for oneself.
Another poem, Where I Don't Live Now. You're not originally from Miami.
No, I'm not.
You were born in New York and spent many years in New England.
Yes.
Was this poem, Where I Don't Live Now, about that?
Where I Don't Live Now, I'd have to actually think about that. I can't really answer that. No, it's in a sense where I don't live now in my spiritual or intellectual sense or fundamental sense in some other way,
mm-hmm.
you know, where I don't live now in the sense of I no longer live as a man who investigates these aspects of life. I now live in this other way. You know, as one changes.
So it's not simply a dislocation of space, but a dislocation of spirit, perhaps.
Certainly. I think that's a better way to put it. You know, I grew up in New York, and I don't live there now. But one of the great things about living in Miami is that it isn't where I grew up, so I see it. I keep a much more aware of the place than I might have been had I stayed in New York, where, you know, things were more familiar.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with local poet Michael Hedick. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
This is 91.3 WLRN and HD1 NPR for South Florida. We're funded by listeners like you and by South Florida Dental Implant Group. Dental implants can alleviate the discomfort of dentures, loss of taste, and difficulty chewing. The South Florida Dental Implant Group, dedicated to giving you the freedom to chew. Details at 1-800-541-3010. We're also funded by Aflac, offering policies which provide cash benefits to help your employees cover expenses due to serious accidents or illnesses. Details and employment opportunities at Aflac Sastre Region Office, 305-445-9958. Taking a look at weather in our area, it's currently 90 degrees in Miami, going to have a possibility of a shower later this afternoon overnight. It's going to be partly to mostly cloudy overnight, and we're going to have a low of about 77 degrees. Thanks for being with us today.
Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is local poet Michael Hedick, whose new collection is entitled The Animals Beyond Us. Michael, William Logan is a poet, but he's best known as a devastating critic.
Mm-hmm.
He once got into trouble for dismissing the American poet Hart Crane as overrated. He called Crane's epic poem on the Brooklyn Bridge a myth of America conceived by Tiffany and executed by Disney. I'm going to put you on the spot now. Is there a famous beloved poet, alive or dead, that you feel has been overrated?
Mm. Okay, let me think for a second. Yes, I would say that Ezra Pound is overrated. Not because of his position as a figure and a person who helped other poets in their careers and gave them great energy and impetus and was a very generous person. But as a poet himself, I think he is not very useful to us anymore, because his language, for all his sense of writing in the American language, is sort of high Victorian, very pretentious to me. I'm speaking for myself, pretentious. And his references are obscure and almost, you know, to track down the references doesn't really give us any food. And I think the number of poems that he wrote that are absolutely excellent is very small. So that's somebody, but that's also somebody that I respond to very quickly on the spot. So as I leave this interview, I'm probably going to feel bad about speaking badly about Ezra Pound.
Well, Pound is always one of those artists or writers that you always have to separate the man from the
work.
Yes,
definitely.
Because, well, you know, obviously he got into trouble later as being a traitor. Doing anti-American and anti-Semitic radio speeches for Mussolini. Well, for me, my name is Billy Collins. Billy Collins, who's a very popular poet, I think is contributing to the dumbing down of American poetry, because I'm sure you've read him.
Oh, of course, yeah.
His poetry is plain, I have no problem with plainness, and I have no problem with being harder, you know, easy to understand, but there's very little obscurity in his poetry.
Right. And also the techniques he's using, he uses over and over again.
Yes. You know?
But the other thing about that, the thing to think about with that is, and I don't entirely agree with you, but I understand what you're saying. I do poetry programs for older people, professionals, you know, people who just like poetry, but they don't write poetry themselves. And one of the people that they love is Billy Collins, almost always. So I think, you know, there's an argument that could say that he draws a lot of people to poetry who otherwise would say, you know, I just don't really have any use for it. It doesn't speak to me.
Right.
So
I mentioned Logan a moment ago. He also wrote that modern poetry is as erotic as a meat locker. Your poems aren't X-rated, but would you agree with Logan? Should the heat be turned up in modern poetry?
Well, I don't think I agree with him. I guess I could say, in a certain sense, there's no sensuous life. I mean, I do agree that there's too little physical life in American poetry. And when I say that, I believe that it's clear as you see the poem on the page too, because the poems have very little physical self. We were talking about formal poetry. I think one of the reasons that our poetry now is very thin physically in its rhythms and cadences and just sense of it of the urgency of a poem as a poem is because there's not enough listening to the rhythms and the sense of cadence that has preceded us. There's not enough of a sense in some ways that we are carriers of the torch. We're carriers of the fire from the past to the future, and we want to know the past to bring something forward into the future. Perhaps American poetry has become, speaking very generally, because I think American poetry is in good shape right now, but perhaps it's become somewhat, you know, solipsistic in a sense that is less interesting than the poetry that's obscure but vividly, powerfully trying to get at something.
Well, a recent poem that was very, I guess, I don't know if you call it erotic, but definitely sexually charged, was one by D.A. Powell. Mm. And he wrote this fascinating poem about Christ's foreskin. And I think to myself, that's brilliant, because nobody ever thought of Christ's foreskin.
Exactly.
I mean, he's a Jew.
Yeah.
Obviously, he was circumcised. Mm-hmm. What happened to it? I mean, it's a
divine
piece of him.
I haven't read that poem.
I mean, you know, it's fascinating. Again, we're speaking with poet Michael Hedick, whose new collection is The Animals Beyond Us. Which contemporary poets do you read for pleasure?
Oh, man, I read a lot. I would say lately. I would say I have to speak lately because I'm always moving through the landscape. You know, Jack Gilbert, Linda Gregg, Louise Gluck, Campbell McGrath. Let's see, Linda Paston, David Budbill, Bob Arnold up in Vermont. I go back. I read, you know, Jack Spicer still. I sometimes still read Philip Whalen. I read Gary Snyder. I love W.S. Merwin. I could keep going.
Keep going on.
You know, there are a lot of people. I think we're in a rich time for poetry. Well, Czesław Miłosz, I read him on and off all the time. So
as you were starting out, which poets influenced you the most?
As I was starting out, Well, that's also a complicated question, because when I was a young kid, my father read poems to me all the time. T.S. Eliot, Robert Frost, you know, great poems. And I did not understand what he was – I didn't understand what he was – what the poems were about. But the intimacy and the pleasure of that experience was really, really profound for me. So those are like fundamental influences. They've always been in my head. When I was – it was just starting as a sophomore in college – the reason I wanted to write poetry in the first place was we read this poem by Cesar Vallejo called Black Stone Lying on a White Stone, which goes something like, I will die in Paris on a rainy day, on some day I already remember, a day like other days, I will die in Paris and I do not step aside. And it was just this sense that one could explore one's own life and the world around oneself in a way that was both vividly specific and also, you know, somewhat surrealistic. Somehow it was fable-like. There was some way of dealing with the world that I had never really encountered, even in T.S. Eliot and those other writers. So I just went into poetry and just read everything I could and just worked on it every day. I mean, I was one of those people that just hit my, you know, discovered the thing I wanted to do and just I gave up everything else and just went for that, you know. So I read everybody. When I was first starting, I luckily enough worked with a poet named Anselm Hollow, who was a Finnish American poet, and he taught me all about the New York poets, the alternative, lines of poetry, Louis Zukofsky, the Objectivists, Reznikov, all these poets that most people don't even read now, you know. And he also taught me the most important thing. I think he taught me was that poetry is a practice, and we do it, and it's not something so special. It's not a special thing we put a like a little box around, but we write it, you know, every day, and it's just part of the way we live our lives, you know. So even though most of the poets he taught me or showed me, Creeley, Denise Levertov, Robert Duncan, Charles Olson, people like that, haven't been really really that important to me as a writer because my sensibility is quite different from theirs. He still really got me going in a certain way that just has kept going all these years since.
This is an election year. Is there a role for politics in poetry?
Yeah, there is. There is, certainly. But it is very difficult to articulate how, I think. There is certainly, although it's going to be poetry that challenges us to think about, you know, the world in the social and political arena, you know, and gives us less room for our own. This is the problem. For me, poetry is something that gives the reader room to move and think and find their own way, right? If a poem is going to be successfully political, I think it has to be much more focused on giving the reader the message that is intended by that poem, right? Unless we're thinking of poetry as just a political act in its very nature.
Well, many poets obviously have dealt with politics.
Certainly.
In their work. Anna Akhmatova wrote about Stalin. Wilfred Owen showed the horrors of World
Certainly.
War I. The title of Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939, right. refers to the day the Nazis invaded Poland and was also very much part of the conversation after 9/11.
Right. But interestingly, wasn't it interesting that was the poem after 9/11,
yes.
After all these years? That was still the poem.
I know, 62
use.
Years
right.
later. Poets have always been viewed as dangerous by the state. That's why Plato said they should be banished from the ideal republic. And yet, there's a misconception. People tend to think that poets will always take a liberal point of view. But if you look at the modernists, Eliot, Yeats, Frost, Stevens, Marion Moore, they're all conservative. So just because you're avant-garde doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be
right.
liberal. Are you?
Right, exactly. What you are is somebody who doesn't think in the box, and that's the challenging. I mean, to use the cliche of thinking in the outside the box, I mean, poetry cannot be controlled in the sense that it's going to fit a particular slogan or think along a particular line. It thinks in the way it thinks as it goes forward, and it discovers what it discovers as it's unfolding, as it's written. And again, that's the function of form. Form, you know, we push against the form, and then we move forward, and something happens. What it is, we don't know until we write the poem. That's why we keep writing poetry. Because it's exciting to see what's going to happen, You know, it's not something that one comes to, you know, with this intention to say something specific. It's something someone comes to discover what's going on in the mind and in the life and in the soul, for lack of a better word, at that particular moment. And that's the great pleasure.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Michael Hedick.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. He also blogs on the Huffington Post. So that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. Follow us at the Topical Currents Facebook page. We have author and book links, discussion, and staff photos. Find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Click on radio. And tomorrow's program is with the co-author of the book, Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Science Left. And to the calendar, on this day in 1905, 107 years ago, the birth of Eddie Rochester Anderson in Oakland. Of course, he played Jack Benny's stereotypical valet on radio and TV. He also appeared in Gone with the Wind. And on this day in 1925, 87 years ago, the birth of baseball's Harvey Haddix, who perhaps pitched the greatest game in the sport's history, only to lose 1-0 after pitching a perfect game for 12 innings for the Pirates, 1959. He retired 36 straight batters. He was also the winning pitcher in the 1960 World Series victory against the Yankees in the memorable Bill Mazeroski walk-off home run game. One more while we get experienced. On this day in 1970, 42 years ago, the death of Jimi Hendrix in London. He was 27. Rolling Stone named him the greatest guitarist of all time. And we leave with a thought from Jimi Hendrix, who saw Elvis perform in Seattle as a boy. Quote, "I've been imitated so well, I've heard people copy my mistakes." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Good afternoon. You're listening.